Welcome to Wiki Politiki, a show designed to bring right and left front and center, to turn the funk into function, and leave the junk at the junction. At a time when so much political discourse is heat without light, Wiki Politiki shines the light of love and truth on the endarkened corridors of power, and then brings leading solutionaries into conversation to light the way forward together. Your host is Steve Behrman, author, comedian, and political and spiritual uncommentator. You might know Steve as his cosmic comic alter ego, Swami Beyondananda, or as the author of a more serious book with cellular biologist Bruce Lipton, Spontaneous Evolution. If you recognize that crisis precipitates evolution, and judging by the current crises, the chances of precipitation are 100%, this show is for you. Welcome to the Evolutionary Uprising. Now, here is your host, Steve Behrman.
Well, hi there, and welcome to Wiki Politiki, Conversations for Co-Creation, where we shed light on the undarkened corridors of power and shine a light ahead of us to where evolution is leading. Purpose of Wiki Politiki is to bring left and right, front and center, to face the music and dance together, to address problems rather than defend positions. Well, today's topic, sex trafficking. Everybody thinks it's bad, right? Everybody. Well, you know, that depends on what you imagine sex trafficking to mean. If the term conjures up innocent women and children being sold into a life of sexual exploitation and slavery, of course we should all be against it. But what if sex trafficking actually applies to any sex for money, even with mutual consent? Our guest on Wiki Politiki today, Veronica Monet, is a one-time sex worker who is now a sexual empowerment change agent, whose website, The Shame-Free Zone, offers a safe place to explore feelings of shame without being judged. As someone who sees her own career as a highly paid escort as an expression of self-empowerment, she has a unique and enlightening perspective on how what we imagine sex trafficking to be has created more repression, confusion, and shame, and doesn't really address where sexual abuse and pedophilia originate inside the family structure. Having grown up in a right-wing Christian cult, herself an incest and rape survivor, Veronica brings a rich history and perspective to the highly politicized and highly charged issues that involve many aspects of sexuality. She's appeared on CNN, Fox, Politically Incorrect, and presented at Yale, Stanford, and UC Berkeley. She is the author of Sex Secrets of Escorts and the soon-to-be-published Love, Lust, and Romance in the Wake of Me Too. Talk about that. And she is creator of the Exquisite Partnership Formula, a program designed to turn conflict into connection and sex that gets better with each passing year. Welcome, Veronica. It's great to have you on our show again.
I'm so glad to be here. Thank you for having me. For now, they think it's the third time, huh?
It's just we'll pretend it's the first time, okay?
Well, I don't know. I think the third time's a charm. So I'm looking forward to our best show yet.
Well, it's the first time this year, and it's a very important time right now. Now, because lots going on. Because of your own history as a sex worker who chose that career as an expression of self-empowerment, let's begin there. Tell us how you came to choose that path and a bit of what it was like for you.
You know, I have had a very unique life. I sometimes have thought it's kind of been a life in reverse. I remember learning to ride a motorcycle before I ever learned how to ride a bicycle. I learned how to skin dive before I ever learned how to swim. So forgive me, but my life is always backwards. And I got clean and sober in a 12-step program when I was just 25 years of age. I had a college diploma. I had already graduated from Oregon State University with honors and a degree in psychology. I moved on to have 7 years in corporate America working as an office manager, a department manager, and then a marketing representative for a radio station. And after all of that, I met a woman who was working as a high-end escort, and I decided to join her in that profession. So I'm 4 years sober, 7 years of corporate experience under my belt, and a college diploma, all of that before I ever became a sex worker. And that's a pretty unusual chain of events. Now, why did I do that? Well, partly because I'm a rebel, partly because I'm very, very curious, partly because I was raised in a very, very conservative Christian cult, and the hypocrisy of all the religious fanatics that were on both sides of the family. We had the Assembly of God people, the Mormon people, my mother's conservative Christian cult. I read the Bible from cover to cover when I was 12, really hoping that somehow or another I would have a spiritual awakening. But man, that book did not get along very well, even at the standard.
Go ahead.
Well, the sexual double standard really bothered me. So I didn't like the idea that women could get all of these labels like slut and whore, but it didn't come back on men. Men could do anything they want. So that rebel in me really wanted to work against that those limits that are placed on women.
Let's talk about the self-empowerment part. You've told me in the past that you felt more empowered in this profession than you did in the corporate world. How did you experience that self-empowerment?
Well, that was actually a shock. I really just wanted to defy the stereotypes and rebel against the sexual double standard, and I wanted to make some money, okay? And they weren't paying me very well in those corporate jobs, and I thought I could make a lot more money doing high-end escorting, and in fact, I did. But it was a real surprise to me to find out how respectful my clients were of me. Now, granted, I want to stress, I was a college-educated woman with a corporate background, so I didn't start off in a massage parlor. I've never worked the streets. Not to in any way say that those are not also respectable places of employment for some people who choose to do that and feel empowered to do that. That's great. But for me, I was entering in at a level that was, it provided me with a lot of choices and a lot of opportunities. So I was, working high-end hotels, and towards the end of my career, I was being flown around the United States exclusively just to see one gentleman at a time. And they were paying me, large sums of money, mostly to sit across from them at a dinner table and talk for hours and hours, but also to provide sexual services. And so that's kind of a glamorous, rarefied world that I walked into. And, I just want to be careful to stress that. So my experience was empowering because I did it from a place of choice. I had a lot of options available, could have done anything I wanted, chose to do this. And being a white college-educated woman, I have a lot of advantages that other people don't when they go into the sex industry. So the empowerment for me was I'm sitting at the as a secretary, feeling kind of taken for granted. Sometimes the CEOs would come into my boss's office. They wouldn't even bother to learn my name. They just asked me to get them a cup of coffee or make a flight arrangement for them or something. And I felt pretty ignored and invisible in those jobs. And then as an escort, men of that even higher caliber, men who were, maybe owned five major corporations and were billionaires, really couldn't wait to ask me my opinion on things. And so that was really interesting to suddenly be in this position of being kind of a muse to the rich and powerful men.
A muse. That's really interesting because here, something about who you were or who they thought you were, they had permission to be intimate maybe in other ways other than sexual.
Well, I think that the pillow talk that happens between an escort and a client is pretty vulnerable. There is a lot of sharing that would probably shock a lot of people. They probably wouldn't think that a powerful, wealthy man would be sharing intimate emotional details of his life with somebody that he was paying for sex. But actually it happens all the time. It's kind of a place where, well, it's really the origins of this shame-free zone that I founded, because I found that powerful, wealthy men who had just had an orgasm were actually very childlike, very vulnerable, and I've seen the tender side of men, and that was also the other shock, Steve, because I was verging on lesbian separatism when I went into the sex industry, and I actually fell in love with men. I just didn't realize how human they could be, and I really had all the same experiences that a lot of women have had, date raped in college, had a boyfriend who was physically abusive to me. All of this happens before I ever go into the sex industry. And of course, that kind of comes with the terrain since I was doing drugs and alcohol. And when I got clean and sober, those parts of my life fell away. But I was really astounded at the difference between the disrespectful and dismissive way that men treated me when I was working in corporate America and when I was also dating in college versus the very almost reverential way that men would approach me when I was a high-end escort. So, you know, and I'm not saying that that's everybody's experience. It just happens to be mine.
Were you ever in danger? Did you ever feel that you were in danger when you were doing that? Or were you?
Yes. So for 12 years, no. For 12 years, so I was in the profession of escorting for 14 years. So mm-hmm. for the first 12 years, which is the bulk of my experience, no, I actually felt very safe. I took precautions, but I did feel safe, and I had beautiful clients. And then that 12th year, I had the misfortune of booking an appointment with a serial rapist. Now, of course, I didn't know he was a serial rapist, but that's what he turned out to be. And I figured out what the situation was when I got there, so I just kind of played along and got out of there as quickly as I could, and then immediately tried to report it to the police. And that was a 3-year battle with the Oakland Police Department, because they did not want to arrest the serial rapist. They wanted to arrest me. Now, I want to stress that prostitution is a misdemeanor with a, at that time, a $500 fine. I mean, we're talking about a really low-level crime here. And a serial rapist was out there harming about 20 women a month. And how did I know that? Because we had a grapevine after he raped me. We all started sharing information. And about 3 weeks after he raped me, he actually stabbed a young 18-year-old girl in the face with a knife. So this is a very dangerous man. And the police were more interested in getting prostitutes who have consensual sex with other people behind bars, which is just insane. Now, I'm happy to report that just last year, 2019, Senator Scott Wiener from the state of California introduced legislation that was signed into law by Governor Gavin Newsom. And this legislation finally makes it possible for working prostitutes to report rape and assault without going to jail, which is not only going to protect sex workers, but it's going to protect the public. So I'm really happy to have finally seen that legislation pass. I was there the day that Scott Wiener announced it. I endorsed the legislation and spoke at his press conference. So
obviously that's many, many years after this happened to you. 20 years or more. Yeah. Many years after. But that's a good step.
Many years after.
Let's take that opportunity now to get into sex trafficking, which for most people, that phrase conjures up images of involuntary slavery. We're going to be interrupted in about 2 minutes when we take a break, but let's get started on this anyway. What's your perspective on sex trafficking?
Well, first of all, trafficking is a problem worldwide. In some ways, though, I don't even like the word trafficking, because then we just focus on people who cross borders. And to me, that's like another issue. We have an issue with the fact that there are countries that have a lot more resources than other countries who don't have a lot of resources. And it's important for us to realize that the inequity between the haves and the have-nots is really where all of these problems originate from. But there is also a fact that some people are working in jobs under conditions that are abysmal, that they do not enjoy, that maybe they initially signed up for, but now it's become oppressed. They've been kind of tricked. Maybe they owe more money than they thought, and they're just never going to get out of debt with the person who provided them with the employment. There's a lot of different circumstances, and each one needs to be taken on a case-by-case basis. But the fact is that most of the slave trafficking, if you will, that happens on this planet has nothing to do with sex. And yet it's the sex trafficking that gets our attention. And I think that's because of the fact that we have a lot of focus on sex, that any type of sex that doesn't take place in the context of procreation or pair bonding is considered repugnant. And that's not always the case. And I know we're getting ready to break here, so I'm gonna pick that up when we come back.
We'll pick it up on the other side of this break, and we'll talk more about sex trafficking from a slightly different point of view. Steve Behrman, Wiki Politiki, will be back after these messages.
Connecting you with the best of the conscious minds in the world. Om Times Radio. IOM FM. Om Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. Om Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
My name is Victor Furman. Some call me The Voice. I've always been fascinated with human nature, spirituality, science, and the crossroads at which they meet. Join me Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern on Om Times Radio, and we'll explore these topics and so much more on Destination Unlimited.
911, what is your emergency?
My kid shot himself.
All right, where's the wounds?
911, what's your emergency?
Please help. My son shot his brother.
911, what is your emergency?
Okay.
911, please state your emergency.
Every day, 8 kids and teens are unintentionally killed or injured by loaded and unlocked guns.
It wasn't locked.
Learn how to make your home safer at endfamilyfire.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and End Family Fire.
Okay, we're back with our guest Veronica Monet. We're talking about sex trafficking. So, what is when people think about sex trafficking, and what's the difference between the representation of slavery, involuntary slavery, and reality?
Okay, well, first of all, I want to introduce your listeners to somebody named Ann Gallagher. Ann Gallagher was actually awarded a Trafficking in Persons Hero Award from Hillary Clinton, who was then the U.S. Secretary of State. That was in 2012. So she has been researching trafficking for a very long time, apparently since 1998. And she put out an article just a couple of years ago about how absolutely abysmal our sex trafficking statistics are. Actually, not just sex trafficking, but any what's called the Global Slavery Index. And she ends up quoting Bill Gates, who says if you can't measure it, it doesn't exist. So that is fine if you're dealing with a virus, which in Gates' case is true. He's been trying to track how he's helping to stem the spread of HIV. But you can't really apply that same way of thinking. You can't really find those kind of statistics when it comes to trafficking figures. So one of the things that she says is that we don't really have any solid statistics. And in fact, there's a way in which the United States has found themselves so embarrassed by a lot of the statistics that they put out there that they've just tried to stop quoting those numbers. So here's the thing. I've done a lot of research on this. I continue to research to try. Does anybody actually know how many sex trafficking victims there are? And mostly what I see is that some government agencies and some nonprofits try to put some figures out there because they really want to justify their budgets. But if you just pull the veil back a little bit and find out where did they get those numbers, they're not reliable. And now you've got also just the experience of people who are actually in the industry. Where is the sex trafficking? What do we know is sex trafficking? And it's far less than what the public is led to believe. But I will tell you one of the things that's helping to increase those statistics, and that's the conflation of adult consensual prostitution with sex slavery. It happens all the time, and I have talked to some women who are actually arrested for prostitution and get their paperwork back. And I think about one woman in particular was arrested by Oakland PD. She lived alone in a duplex with some other adults who also lived alone. There were no children there. On her paperwork, it says child endangerment and sex trafficking. And she's like, I work by myself for myself, and I don't have any children. Why does it say this on my paperwork? I could tell you the short answer is because it justifies a budget. You are able to procure more money from the federal government if you can make a case for having rescued a certain number of sex trafficking victims. So what we have now is basically we've completely funneled in. Anything that used to be referred to as prostitution is now sex trafficking. The premise or the assumption that we have around this is that no adult woman could actually make a voluntary choice to sell sex for money. So therefore, she's deluded, she needs therapy, somebody must have coerced her into it, convinced her to do it, and furthermore, if we could just put sex trafficking on this paperwork, we will get more money from the federal government, and so that's how it works. I'm not trying to say that there aren't actually sex trafficking victims, but I am saying this. As long as we continue to confuse adult consensual prostitution with sex trafficking, we won't help anybody. And, you know, I was on a panel back in 2008. I was in Miami. I was sitting right next to the head of Miami Vice. And I asked him, I said, tell me about the sex trafficking victims that you have rescued. And he told me about this young woman that he felt very, very proud that he had arrested her, which is what rescuing, they call that rescuing now. They arrest the prostitute and they call that rescuing a victim. And she said, oh, yes, I don't want to do this. This is not my choice. And I got to tell you something, especially if you are an immigrant, you don't want to admit to having chosen to do prostitution because you're going to get deported. Now, in this woman's case, I asked him, well, what happened to her after you rescued her? And he goes, well, she went right back to working as a prostitute. So that's kind of interesting.
I'm waiting for my next rescue here.
Yeah, I said, rescue me again.
Yes, you see, this is how it plays into that very conservative Christian idea that you've been talking about, because there are a lot of people who have this fervency about sex trafficking, quote unquote, but when you scratch the surface, what they have the issue with is, as you said earlier, consensual sex for money, and maybe even sex, and maybe even sex. So a lot of that's been conflated and confused by this persistent hypocritical moralism that you started out describing. Does that make sense?
Well, it's absolutely. Now, California Proposition 35, which is a ban on human trafficking and sex slavery, was passed in 2012. And I was active in trying to get that legislation vetoed. We wanted to vote it down. Stanford University was having a roundtable on the topic. They had the woman there who had introduced the legislation, and they had not invited a single sex worker to this roundtable. So I invited myself, and I spoke. I spoke there. You know, I'm sure they didn't want me there, but they would have had a hard time. It would have been really difficult for them if they had said no, because we would have taken that to a press. It's like, oh, Stanford's going to talk about sex trafficking legislation, but they won't allow any sex workers to speak to them. So I did speak there, and I met the woman who had co-authored the legislation with the help of her attorney. Now, this woman was a very devout Christian woman who had been sitting in her living room watching some movie about sex trafficking, and she decided that she wanted to do something about it. So she contacted her attorney, and they wrote up legislation. And I got to tell you something, there is not a politician alive who would want to vote against enforcing sex trafficking laws. That's just like the death of your political career. But no, because nobody bothers to read the fine print. Nobody bothers to research the topic. And if you use a word like sex trafficking, somebody is always going to vote, yes, we don't want sex trafficking. So I am happy to say we were able to dissuade the Sacramento Bee, which is the paper in Sacramento. We asked them to please not endorse Proposition 35. And in fact, they came out with an editorial saying, encouraging the public to vote against Proposition 35 because primarily it would harm communities of color. Because as with almost any prohibition, whether it's drugs, alcohol, or sex, when you're trying to institute laws that are basically based on the model of prohibition, it almost always unfairly impacts communities of color. And unfortunately, the proposition did pass. It has made life a living hell for sex workers. Nobody feels rescued, I can tell you that. That's where we're at. And what will happen with the sex trafficking laws a lot of times is that they get introduced from out of state by religious organizations whose, I don't know if it's such a secret, but their ultimate agenda is to make all sex work illegal, even when it's not sex trafficking, even when it's consensual adult behavior. They just want to eradicate it.
And the same thing is true of other women's rights issues like abortion and that. We can talk a little bit about that as well. Let's move on to something that is related to that, and that is the issue of pedophilia. And there's an entire subculture in this country, and one which helped elect Donald Trump president, where people are convinced that Hillary Clinton is part of an elite pedophile ring. And there's this entire Pizzagate phenomenon where people have tuned in, and they're convinced that the arrests are going to commence any day now. And I've known people who are very involved in this idea, in this quest for uncovering this pedophile elite. What is your take on this in terms of the kinds of people who might get focused or hooked on issues like this, and perhaps the real deal about pedophilia? Where is pedophilia most commonly found?
Yes, great question. Pedophilia is most commonly found in the home. And it, here's the thing. I think a lot of people are sexual abuse survivors and don't even know it. They're in denial about it. And that is an understandable and very normal defense mechanism that the human brain operates from. Trauma can be incredibly debilitating. It can immobilize you. So the brain has all kinds of defense mechanisms for trying to shunt certain traumatic events off to the side so that we can continue to function. Unfortunately, though, the trauma stays in our tissues. There's a fabulous book by a man named Vander Kolk. He is a psychologist, and I think he's a genius. He wrote a best-selling book called The Body Keeps the Score. Highly recommend that your listeners check this book out, The Body Keeps the Score by Vander Kolk. And one of the things that is, we can't really control what our brain does, but if we have the interest in trying to heal ourselves, we can start to unravel our own mysteries. And each one of us has got some kind of trauma in our past. Some of us more than others. Some of us it's just slight, but for some of us it's quite extreme. Myself, I have complex trauma. And there's various ways that you can start to unravel that. I've done lots of therapy. EMDR is an excellent way to start to heal. So are 12-step groups, because people get together and talk about the shameful things that have happened in their lives in an atmosphere of acceptance and love, and it removes the shame and it helps people heal. Those things are awesome. Yoga is also another proven way to get past that trauma. But as long as you're carrying that trauma in your tissues, you're kind of on high alert. There's a part of your brain that just is constantly telling you there's something wrong, but you don't know where it's coming from. And most children who have been abused by their parents, whether through physical abuse or sexual abuse or emotional abuse, gaslighting, whatever kind of abuse they suffered in their childhood, are kind of walking around with a certain level of post-traumatic stress disorder, a certain level of reactivity, and they're kind of on high alert. So when they hear some of these conspiracy stories, it really resonates with that part of them that knows that there's danger, that part of them that knows they're wounded, and they attach to that. So you can look at my family of origin, both sides, my mother's side, my father's side. The danger was always without. It was always a stranger in the dark bushes who was going to jump out and get you with a knife. It was always people who looked different than us or talked different than us or worshiped different than us. Those were the people we had to be careful about. But in reality, the pedophile was in our house. The rapist and the wife beater was in the house. And the denial that has to be in place to ignore that fact, to not realize that it's the minister or the pastor or the preacher or maybe the priest that's got a pedophilia problem or is sexually inappropriate. To be able to turn a blind eye to all that stuff, we project it out onto the other.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty accurate. That's a pretty accurate, accurate description. And you know, I don't know what the statistics are, and perhaps you know, you have some idea of what percentage of men and women have been sexually abused as children. Is it 10%?
I imagine it's grossly underreported, but the statistics that have been around now for several decades are basically somewhere between 1 in 4 and 1 in 5 women have been sexually abused as children. Depends on which statistic, but at the very least, 20%. And it's slightly lower for males, but I'm not real convinced that that's true. I kind of think that we've got a severe case of underreporting in male survivors and this kind of leads into another topic that you and I were going to talk about, which is the idea that women can rape men. So we've got like kind of a cultural narrative here that basically just says men are perpetrators and women are victims. And I don't buy into that gendered take on perpetration. I think that people of any gender are capable of perpetrating. And I recently came across some interesting research that's just come out within like the last 4 years. And it spawned a new term. I'd never heard this word before, but it's called forced to penetrate. It turns out that some men have been forced to have sexual intercourse by women. Now, in the most cases, this is usually an ongoing relationship. So it might be an abusive relationship where she has physically abused him. And this is another thing we have kind of a blind spot around, which is that women can physically abuse men. Now, there's a reason, Steve, that this is possible. Yes, by and large, most men are taller, bigger, stronger, have more upper body strength than most women. So we think this is impossible. Okay, but it's not. And it's not impossible for a person of male gender to be physically or sexually abused by a person of female gender. And there's a very simple scientific explanation for this. It has to do with how the brain processes trauma. So if the brain goes into a place of fear, it has four responses that it can elicit. We can fight, right? We can flee, run away. We can freeze, or we can fawn. Now let's go into that freeze. That freeze response actually has can tip over into something called tonic immobility. And tonic immobility makes it impossible for you to speak or move. 70% of all rape victims, female rape victims, have experienced some level of tonic immobility while they were being raped, meaning that they couldn't speak or move. But because we don't make this common knowledge, most of us are running around feeling we don't believe her because she didn't fight back or yell or scream or say no. And we don't believe ourselves because we wonder why we didn't fight back or say no. But I'm wanting to invite us to have so much more compassion for ourselves. Our brains are constructed to behave this way. It's beyond our control, and we need to have compassion for what happens in traumatic circumstances. Now, going back to how men can be raped by women.
I'm going to stop you right there because we're going to take a little break. We want to continue with, with the rest of this conversation when we get back with Veronica Monet. This is Steve Behrman on Wiki Politiki.
Free your mind with Om Times Radio, IOM FM.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free, ascendinghearts.com.
More than 24 million Americans have an autoimmune disorder, and that number continues to grow. I'm Sharon Saylor, and I'm one of those 24 million. To put that number in perspective, cancer affects about 9 million and heart disease up to 22 million. That's why I've brought together top experts and those thriving regardless of their diagnosis to bring you the latest, most up-to-date information. Join me, Sharon Saylor, Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern, for the Autoimmune Hour on Life Interrupted Radio to find out how to live your life uninterrupted.
Are you done with the daily barrage of negativity? Ready for some positivity? Creations Magazine has been inspiring the soul for over 30 years, delivering thought-provoking and solution-driven articles, essays, and poetry that inspire you to enjoy a vibrant life. Holistic health, personal and spiritual growth, relationships, the environment, and so much more. Read us online or order a subscription, creationsmagazine.com.
Imagine being fired because of who you love. Imagine being denied medical treatment because of who you marry. Imagine being evicted because of who you are. Millions of Americans don't have to imagine this. They have to live it. Because in 31 states, it's legal to discriminate against LGBT people. Get the facts at beyondido.org. Brought to you by the Gill Foundation and the Ad Council.
Okay, we're back with our guest, Veronica Monet. We were talking about sexual abuse, and we're talking about how it's possible for women to rape men. Finish up your thoughts on that. I have something that came to me about it as well. Go ahead.
Okay, so just again going to the science of the brain when we're in the freeze response can lead to an advanced form of freeze response, which is tonic immobility, and that makes it impossible for you to speak or move. That affects about 70% of female rape survivors. So it's important to know that that can also affect men, because we're just talking about the human body and the human brain and how it responds to stress. Let's go one step further and understand that when the body is being assaulted, sexually assaulted, it will sometimes respond with sexual arousal. We've known this for a long time in the case of women. We've known that sometimes they might actually lubricate and have an orgasm. And that's very confusing to the rape survivor, because she absolutely hated the rape, did not want the rape, would have done anything she possibly could to avoid it. And yet her body, it feels like her body's betrayed her. Similarly, for men, their bodies can achieve an erection when they don't actually wish to have sex. And that is not really, if we start to think about the times that men have gotten erections when it wasn't their doing, that kind of starts in school usually, or all of a sudden there's a spontaneous erection, and there's no explanation for it. How do I hide this? You know, this is like kind of a issue that's common to a lot of young boys. And it can also happen under moments of stress. So being forced to have sex against one's will is a stressful situation. I think that it's important that we start moving past some of our stereotypes about gender and our stereotypes about sex, and really acquaint ourselves with how the human brain and the human body actually functions.
Mm-hmm. You know, the other thing that occurs to me is that every few years there's a story about usually a young woman teacher who is maybe in her 20s or early 30s, usually fairly attractive, who ends up getting into affairs with her junior high school students, boy students. And it occurs to me that there's the issue of sex and power. That, you know, part of the leveraging might have to do with, you know, somebody who's in a position of authority, who has, like almost like an employer-employee or a therapist-client relationship. Is that, have you thought about that at all?
Well, that's kind of a different topic in some ways, because I'm talking about what the body and the brain do when it's being assaulted.
Right.
And you're talking about power differentials and also age of consent. So I often tell people, I said, age of consent is something we all believe in, because we just sometimes argue about what it should be. And it's actually, it varies by state here in the United States. So some states have it fairly young. Some states require you to be 18. I think that's a pretty protracted discussion about when do we actually think somebody is old enough to consent to sex. And also the age differential really is important, I believe. But there again, how much of an age differential do we find egregious, and how much is acceptable? Is 2 years okay? Let's say somebody's 16 and somebody else is 18. How do we feel about that? Versus somebody is 16 and somebody's 32. That usually makes us feel very differently. I think that age can be incredibly indicative of a power differential, and as is also one's position. So if one is a parent or a preacher or a teacher or a coach, you are basically in a position where that other human being is surrendering their will to you in order for you to be able to do your job or to fulfill that role for them. And so any way that you lead them astray for your own sexual agenda is abusive and should be penalized. And this extends also to yoga gurus. We're seeing quite a few scandals of that nature come out lately too.
Yep. Well, I think any position of authority or where people are put on a pedestal, there's also the sexuality of and charisma of being somebody who is in the public eye, being somebody who is who is adored. You know, there's a susceptibility to that. In the time that we have left, what I'd like to talk about, you know, your new book is talking about the age of Me Too, and now the Me Too movement is 2 years old. It's going through its terrible twos. It's at least 2 years old now. It's like, no. What's with the 2 year perspective since we last talked about this, what's your take on it, and how is it evolved, and where does it need to evolve next?
Well, we just saw a conviction for Harvey Weinstein, and that was really where the Me Too movement began in the public eye. Tarana Burke actually launched that hashtag Me Too 10 years before it was popularized by Hollywood. But Harvey Weinstein was kind of the entry point for a lot of us to be familiarized with it. And he is definitely going to do prison time. I'm working on an article right now. It really kind of starts around a comment from Ashley Judd, who is one of the people that Harvey sexually assaulted. And she said that it would have been better if there kind of had been some kind of restorative justice for Harvey, and instead of it just having to be a prison term. And I understand where she's coming from. I'm kind of exploring that whole idea. Most of the examples of restorative justice that I see actually work very well with young kids that are still in school. And the community is brought to bear. There's a huge educational process that goes around this, which is great. But I'm not entirely convinced that it would work with adults, especially if they don't feel that they're kind of ensconced in a community that they depend on. If they have independent means, they could be probably pretty entrenched in their behaviors. And maybe prison time is the only thing that would work. I don't know. Just kind of exploring that topic, but I do know this. I don't think that we can go forward and fully heal our issues around sexuality and consent until we've got an approach that invites men to the table to talk about this. Right now, I feel like men are being silenced for fear of saying the wrong thing.
God forbid.
And at the same time, I don't want to lose the importance of the righteous rage that a lot of women are feeling. I think it's important that women are angry. I'm grateful to have the Me Too movement. As somebody who has survived incest and rape and been sexually harassed on the job and literally walked away from any association with Hollywood because I had some Me Too moments myself with a couple of producers, I think that it's so important that we're at this time in history. But I just looking for that forward vision of how to move forward. I'm looking for ways that we can heal and we can reframe what consent looks like for people of any gender so that I just really want to see a world where nobody has sex that they don't want to have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that that's really the true integrity way of doing it. You know, one of the thoughts that occurred to me, and this has happened in groups that I've been in, is sometimes the women will make an inner circle and have a conversation, and then the men are sitting around in the outer circle simply as listeners and observers, and then there's a switch, and the men are in the inner circle sharing with each other. And the women are observers on the outside, you know, and it might be that you know, something of that nature where there can be honesty without the emotional charge and accusations and all of that that comes from, as you had suggested earlier, all of us being subject to the craziness of the sexual mores in this country and the unacknowledged abuses and the hypocrisy. In fact, I just saw there was a conservative Republican legislator who had resigned a few years ago because of some financial scandal, who had been sponsored anti-gay legislation, who just came out as being gay.
Not surprising.
No, not at all surprising. So this brings me to the other aspect, and maybe one of the key aspects of your work and message, and that is, you know, calling your website and your project the Shame-Free Zone. So what is it about shame? Is there anything good about shame? And how can we heal this? How can we heal the shame that we've imposed on ourselves and have had imposed on us?
Well, thank you for that question. Great question. First of all, if you go to my office in Grass Valley, downtown Grass Valley, it says Veronica's Shame-Free Zone right over the door. So I'm the Shame-Free Zone, whether I'm doing a podcast or I'm on my website or I'm blogging or you come to my office for a coaching session. It's about healing the shame. Do I think there's any good shame? Actually, no, I don't. I think it has been a cornerstone of human civilization for a long time. I think it's outlived its purpose. It was a way for us to control people within the tribe, within the community, and you know, then within the nation. But just as we no longer want to use religion to control people, kind of moved more, you know, towards secular, where we allow people to worship as they choose, but we don't try to control them with a particular religion. I think it's important that we move away from trying to control human behavior with shame. And the big reasons that I feel that way, aside from the fact that shame can be crippling and damaging and painful, is that I think it's counterproductive. When people feel ashamed of their behavior, they are more likely to perpetrate. So it's counterintuitive. It's counterproductive. It is actually giving us more problems. When you shame somebody, you kind of drive it deeper into them, and it becomes a vicious cycle. So when I'm teaching people how to move away from rage and violence, because I'm an anger management coach, the first thing I do is move them away from feeling ashamed of their perpetrations and into a place where we can openly discuss that in a way where they feel human again, they feel accepted, they feel loved, and we're just learning new behaviors. And then I move them into better boundaries, which is always a shock to my anger management clients because, you know, they come in feeling ashamed and thinking that they're bad. And I have to disavow them of that if I ever want them to stop being violent. So because I know that you can't really elicit improved human behavior if you continue to shame them, it's one of the reasons that I don't want to shame people. It's not that I'm co-signing bad behavior, not at all. But I actually like to teach something I call exquisite selfishness. I want people to start to realize how being respectful of other people is in their best interest.
Say something more about that in the minute we have left. How is that true?
In the minute that we have left, if you realize that your destructive, dysfunctional, abusive behavior is harming you, that it's lowering your self-esteem and your quality of life, you're much more motivated to change it. So if we go back to Harvey Weinstein, if he realized that his behavior was actually destroying him, that it contributed to his low self-esteem, that it was deteriorating the quality of his life, he might be more interested in getting recovery around whatever issue he's got there. I don't know if he's got a sex addiction or if he's just a power freak, but that's where I start.
The two go together. Well, we've come to the end of our conversation for today, Veronica Monet, the Shame-Free Zone. If you go to my website, wikipolitiki.com, and go to today's show, you'll be able to find a link to her work. Thank you so much, Veronica, for shedding light on some of these darkened pieces that we've had to deal with.
My pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you. This is Steve Behrman, Wiki Politiki. We'll be back again next week.